Hi, thank you very much. It's great to be here. I'm going to be discussing, as you said, the systems level evidence for the role of the cerebellum in autism. And in order to do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the cerebellum and also about the functional topography of the cerebellum. And so like the cerebral cortex has different functional regions, we talk about motor cortex, we talk about visual cortex. Similarly, what we've seen recently based on human imaging studies, clinical studies, and anatomical studies, is that there are functional subregions of the cerebellum. And so this is incredibly relevant when thinking about autism because, you know, most people's immediate thinking about the cerebellum is motor control, so maybe repetitive movements. But this recent evidence suggests that it may be involved in more broader aspects of the autism phenotype. And so the cerebellum means little brain. It looks like a little brain. It has deep white matter covered with lots of folded cortex. We cerebellar people like to spit out stats about it's 10% of the volume of the brain. It has 50% of the neurons in the brain packed into this structure, so it has to do something interesting. And it's traditionally considered a motor structure, but it's involved not in, you know, if it's damaged, you're not paralyzed, but your movement isn't modulated appropriately. It's involved in modulation, adaptation, and learning. So in order to acquire an internal model of a skill, you need to actually learn as well. And so when we think about the role of the cerebellum in both motor control and also potentially cognitive control, we need to think of it in that you're not losing these functions, but what you're losing is the modulation, the control, and the ability to implicitly acquire these functions, which makes things easier. So it's sort of this ability to act on autopilot, which we use for skills, multiple skills, including social skills in social interactions. And so this traditional view has been challenged by a variety of different findings coming from clinical domains, particularly Jeremy Schmalman and Janet Sherman in 98 described a syndrome called the cerebellar cognitive affective syndrome. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It entails cognitive and affective symptoms following cerebellar damage. So this is in addition, or in fact in lieu of, the traditional cerebellar motor syndrome that you would read about in a textbook, where you would have difficulty with posture, motor control, dysmetria of movement. And Schmalman proposed that there's this, like Ito, that there's a cognitive component where you have dysmetric thought as well. And so these patients have difficulties in the language domain, visual spatial domain, executive function, so not things you would traditionally think the cerebellum might be involved in. And so from my perspective, it's very interesting to think about, you know, are the same regions of the cerebellum involved in, say, a cognitive task versus a motor task. Another really important piece of information in terms of the role of the cerebellum beyond motor control comes from anatomical evidence showing connections between the cerebellum and the prefrontal cortex. So again, this is a region of the brain we traditionally consider to be, you know, executive function, prefrontal cortex, and there are connections between this area and the cerebellum. From a developmental perspective, which is my particular area of interest, there are cerebellar structural and functional differences in a range of developmental disorders, including autism, dyslexia, and ADHD. And so one of the questions I had is whether or not the same or different regions of the cerebellum are implicated. So just a quick kind of orientation within the cerebellum. The cerebellum has a lot of anatomy, actually, and it's quite beautiful. And it can be divided into 10 different lobules. And these are just like the bulges and the folds that you see in the cerebral cortex, but I'll be referring to them throughout the talk. And so this is a color-coded image from the suit atlas developed by Diedrichsen. And you can see lobules 1 through 4 are coded in yellow, lobule 5 in green. These together make up the anterior portion of the cerebellum. The posterior lobe is comprised of lobules 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, and these are actually really big in humans compared to lower primates. And so anatomically, this is how I'll be talking about these different subdivisions. Lobule 7 is really quite big, and it can be divided into crust 1 and crust 2. So there's your quick vocabulary lesson. There's a lot of different ways that people have named these regions of the cerebellum, so it can get confusing, but I think numbering from 1 to 10 is quite straightforward. So when we talk about cerebellar circuitry at a systems level, the cerebellum is incredibly richly interconnected with both the cord and the cortex. So it has the capacity to potentially modulate the function of many different areas of the brain. And it does so in this closed loop way. So where the cerebellum projects to, so this is an example from Kelly and Strick, the connections to the prefrontal cortex, the cerebellum projects from the cerebellar cortex to the deep nuclei within the cerebellum, to the thalamus, to the cortex. And then wherever it's projecting to, it receives a circuit projecting back to the cerebellum. And so this sets it up perfectly to modulate and adapt activity in those areas. And it also means that there's this modular organization within the cerebellum where you have the potential for little functional subunits that don't talk much to each other in terms of long-range connectivity, like you see in the cerebral cortex, but they talk to other areas of cortex in this closed-loop fashion. And because we have these projections that we know are between the cerebellum and prefrontal cortex, this gives us the anatomical substrate for a role of the cerebellum in cognition. There are also connections to limbic areas of the brain, so a potential substrate for the role of the cerebellum in emotion. And down here, this is a recent functional connectivity analysis by Randy Buckner's group. They had 500 subjects and then replicated in 500 subjects. And there are color-coded circuits. And what you can see here is that the areas of the brain involved in motor control, which is the blue circuit, only maps to the top part of the cerebellum and this region in lobule 8. And the big lateral hemispheres of the cerebellum map out to association and prefrontal areas of the cortex. And so we talk about this functional topography. When I say functional topography, I'm talking about maps of the connections between the cerebellum and the rest of the brain. In the cerebellum, we know that there's this little upside-down motor homunculus man in the anterior lobe, and also secondary representations in lobule 8. And these lateral areas of the hemispheres are where we see connections with prefrontal and parietal cortices. So if you look at imaging data, when you see activity in the motor cortex, you see predictable activity in these motor homunculi regions of the cerebellum. And when you have activity in frontal and parietal areas, you see the activation sort of filling out these lateral regions of the cerebellum. And so there's your background, but how does this apply to autism? Is this actually useful in terms of the cerebellar findings in autism? It's a reasonably consistent finding that there are cerebellar differences, but how do you interpret them in the context of the disorder beyond motor control? And so when we talk about this functional topography, we see different regions of the cerebellum are engaged during motor versus cognitive tasks. And so, for example, in this image, this has a cutout through a rendered cerebellum. Again, you see motor, which is in red, in the anterior part of the cerebellum and lobule 8, whereas the blue task is a language task, the purple is a working memory task, and the green is a visual spatial task. And you can see that both looking across studies, so this is a meta-analysis. Again, you see this pattern where motor is kind of at the top and the bottom, the cognitive tasks start to fill out the hemispheres, and also within subject analyses. So this is a study showing that if you have subjects all perform 5 tasks, you see this relative topography within the cerebellum. And so in the context of studying autism, this is how I'm approaching this. So I'm saying, where are the cerebellar findings in autism? Does it make sense in terms of the context of the phenotype of the disorder? And so we have 3 studies, and because I have 3 studies I want to show you, I can't give you the details of any one study, but I'm happy to talk with anyone afterwards if you want the details. The first study was to look at where the convergent findings are. So we have many VBM studies, voxel-based morphometry studies of autism. Where are the most consistent findings, particularly within the cerebellum? And so we did this using a meta-analysis approach. And the second study is taking a more prospective approach and looking at children with ASD versus typically developing children using voxel-based morphometry, and also looking at the relationship between what we see in the cerebellum, if anything, and scores on the ADOS and ADI scales. The final study, which I'm only going to touch upon, is using patients who have cerebellar damage. So in terms of the developmental disorders, the cerebellum is part of these larger circuits. There are many areas of the brain that are implicated. In terms of children that have had cerebellar damage as a result of tumor surgery, we kind of know that the problem is starting in the cerebellum. So they're an interesting population to use as a model in terms of looking at potential role of the cerebellum in cognitive and affective disorders. So the first study in this meta-analysis, the goal was to say, okay, where are the structural differences located in the cerebellum? So we're not treating the cerebellum as like one big structure. It has so much beautiful anatomy. We wanted to really localize where the differences are. The other question that we had is, because ADHD, dyslexia also have cerebellar findings, are the findings the same or are they different? So is this kind of a general vulnerability, or is this something more specific to the circuits involved in each disorder? And so what we did is we used this method called the ginger ale activation likelihood estimate method of meta-analysis, which effectively takes the peak values reported in a variety of studies, treats them as centers of probability distributions, and looks for the places where in the brain where they're effectively overlapping, where you have the highest likelihood of seeing a difference between one group and the other. And so we looked at VBM studies reporting direct comparisons between autism spectrum groups and typically developing controls. And based on the history of what had been found anatomically in autism, both at the molecular level in terms of Purkinje cells and also in terms of MRI evidence, we were predicting that there was something going to be happening in midline posterior regions, this midline Burmese region, and also lateral regions of lobule 7. And so what did we find? In terms of location where ASD group tended to show higher gray matter density than typically developing controls, it was in one of the deep nuclei of the cerebellum, the dentate nucleus. And so this is shown in yellow. This is a rendering with a cutout. And interestingly, this part of the dentate nucleus is considered a quote-unquote non-motor region of the nucleus. It's in the ventral part of the dentate. This is where we see connections with prefrontal and association cortices. Another thing that is interesting in terms of trying to interpret what this might mean is that this green area here, which is slightly hard to see maybe, is an area where in cerebellar stroke patients we find damages associated with differences, lower full-scale IQ scores. So again, this suggests that this finding might not be related to motor function, but could be related to cognitive function. In terms of the regions where the autism group showed reduced gray matter relative to controls, we actually looked at the whole brain, because one of the questions was, is the cerebellum relevant in terms of the whole brain in autism? And actually, this midline region in lobule 9, part of the vermis, was the most significant cluster out of the entire brain. So this is a significant finding. It's a consistent finding in autism, and we can really start to think about what does this mean in terms of the etiology of the disorder. Another finding that we had was this cluster out in right crus 1 and another cluster in left 8B. And so how do we actually think about interpreting these findings? So we can think about them in the context of this functional topography that we see in healthy controls. So, for example, this right crus 1 structure, this right crus 1 cluster, is where we see activation during language and working memory tasks in healthy controls. This cluster in 8B is where we see activation during motor tasks in healthy controls. So it could be that these clusters actually mean something slightly different in terms of the circuits that are disrupted in autism. This midline cluster, which was the most significant cluster in the brain in this analysis, is associated with the connectivity of the default network when you look at functional connectivity studies in healthy controls. So again, this is a network that has been implicated in autism, and the cerebellum is part of this wider network. The region where the most consistent finding is found in this meta-analysis is actually associated with connectivity of this default network. In terms of whether or not this is specific to ASD populations or a more general developmental vulnerability, the regions that we found were consistently reduced in gray matter volume in dyslexia in green and ADHD in blue were not the same circuits as the one we were seeing in autism. And this suggests that when we think about these disorders, they have very different sets of symptoms associated with it and some overlapping symptoms in terms of ADHD and autism. But they might be involved in different cerebellar circuits, so different circuits with the cerebral cortex. So this functional topography standpoint helps us to start to interpret some of these findings. And so now meta-analysis has limitations. You know, you're throwing together a bunch of studies. They were all acquired on different scanners. They had different analysis methods. And in terms of registration, the cerebellum can get a bit tricky in that it gets elongated in some studies. And so we wanted to look at this prospectively by doing our own voxel-based morphometry in ASD and also looking at the relationships of the regions that we're finding with symptoms from the ADOS and the ADI scales. And so this data set was very generously shared with us by Stuart Mostofsky and his group at Johns Hopkins, and it consisted of 59 ASD and 59 control children. They were matched for age. The average age was 10 years and 3 months, and the range was 9 to 12 years. And so we did a VBM, again, of the whole brain, because we're interested in how relevant are the cerebellar findings in the context of the whole brain. But also we looked at the cerebellum specifically using this suit atlas, which basically most imaging studies, not most, but quite a few imaging studies will just show you the cortex and they'll pull off the cerebellum. This does the opposite. It pulls off the cerebellum and brainstem, and the heck with the rest of the brain. And so we use that to specifically look at different lobules within the cerebellum. And our predictions based on the meta-analysis was that the ASD group would show less gray matter volume in right crus 1 and in midline lobule 9. And when we actually looked at the lobular volumes, we didn't see any significant differences between the ASD and the typically developing groups, either in individual lobules or overall. One of the things that was interesting is that we did actually be able to separate the HFA, high-functioning autism, and the Asperger's group, and they showed different directions in terms of the size of lobules in this midline area of the vermis. I don't exactly know what this means, but this comes up again later, so I'm showing this to you now. What you see is that the control group volumes sort of sit between the HFA group, which tend to have larger volumes, and the Asperger's group, which tended to have smaller volumes. In terms of the comparison for gray matter volume, there are some regions that are in the ballpark of the meta-analysis, which is very encouraging, but it wasn't always in the same direction as what we saw in the meta-analysis. We did see that there is less gray matter volume in right crus 1, and in terms of the whole brain analysis, this was the most significant cluster in the whole brain. In terms of the vermis in the midline region, this is not exactly the same place where we saw the reduction in the meta-analysis, and it's actually an increase. So there's a higher gray matter volume in this area of midline in this particular group of ASD versus typically developing children. So how do we actually interpret? Can we use the functional topography to try to, again, interpret these findings? This region of right crus 1, where we see reduction in gray matter in ASD compared to typically developing controls, is actually right in the region where we see language activation in the cluster from a meta-analysis looking at functional imaging studies. So could be related to maybe the communication or the social differences that you see in ASD rather than repetitive behavior, which is kind of the obvious association with the cerebellum. In terms of where we see the larger gray matter volume in the ASD group in this vermis 8A region, this is an area where functional connectivity studies suggest that it's part of sensory motor networks. So this is where the little second little homunculus men are sitting in the cerebellum. So this in could be related to more motor aspects of ASD. So what we did is looked at the correlations between these gray matter findings and these scores on the ADOS and the ADI batteries. And so we were interested in which regions we saw correlations between gray matter and scores on these batteries. Just right off the bat, we didn't find any significant correlations with the ADOS communication or repetitive movement scores, the ADI social or repetitive movement scores. But again, I'm going to come back to those repetitive movement scores when I talk about differentiating out the Asperger's and the HFA group. So in terms of the social subtests, the higher scores were associated with this reduced gray matter volume in right crus 1. So this is just the area where we're seeing a significant reduction in gray matter volume in the ASD group, but also in 7B extending into 8A. And so how do we interpret this, again, in terms of topography and what we see in other populations? So here's where we see the VBM differences. This is where this gray matter area is correlating, and it's correlating with the social score. So again, suggesting that this might not have to do with necessarily a motor difficulty. And interestingly, this is the same region where we see that poorer language scores are associated with damage to this area in adult stroke patients. So there's a lot of converging evidence that this is not a typical motor in terms of how we think of motor performance aspect of these various disorders. It might be more related to language processing. In terms of communication scores, we actually see, again, 7B extending into 8A. And these are all these are negative correlations that I'm reporting, which means that the higher the score, the lower the gray matter volume. And so getting back to this repetitive behaviors, so we didn't actually see in the whole group that there were any significant cerebellar correlations with these scores. In the Asperger's group, however, the ADOS repetitive behavior score correlated with gray matter in bilateral lobule 8. So again, this is sort of a motory area of the cerebellum, extending into 9, and also in this midline cluster, which is consistent with what we're seeing in the actual VBM findings. In the high-functioning autism group, the ADI repetitive scores showed a negative correlation, so a negative correlation, higher scores are associated with less gray matter in bilateral lobule 8. So again, associated with motor regions of the cerebellum, and to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure why this is going in different directions, and if anyone has creative ideas, I'm open to suggestions. And so what this is showing is that we're not just talking about the cerebellum as a whole. We're talking about the cerebellum in terms of functional subunits of these regions, and that it's quite important to consider the functional subunits when interpreting the findings, and that we shouldn't just consider the cerebellum as a purely motor structure, because the complexity of the type of modulation that the cerebellum does could be important for a wide range of cognitive, affective, as well as motor tasks. The third study was to look at pediatric cerebellar patients, so patients we know have cerebellar damage, and particularly we were interested in looking at a syndrome called posterior fossa syndrome. This is a really complex syndrome that can sometimes emerge following surgery for a cerebellar tumor. It's associated with mutism, it's associated with ataxia, and it's also associated with emotional ability. So they can go from a completely flat affect to the other extreme of pathological laughter and crying, and there's a real difficulty in modulating these behaviors, as well as a severe expressive language impairment. And it's potentially been associated with damage to the posterior midline vermis. So this is an area that we see commonly in autism. You do see it in some other syndromes. And so the question here was, you know, what is the association? Where do the kids with posterior fossa syndrome actually have cerebellar damage? And so thus far, we've processed the data from 11 cerebellar patients. 7 of them were males. They're quite young. 60% of childhood brain tumors are in the posterior fossa, which includes the cerebellum. And the ages range from 1 year to 9 years and 8 months old. And so it can be a little difficult in terms of the neuropsychology because they're obviously going to have different batteries. They've all had a surgically resected cerebellar tumor. They've all had MRI scans and full neuropsychological assessments, and they've had these assessments prior to radiation treatment if they're having radiation treatment. In this sample, 4 out of the 11 patients, or about 36%, had posterior fossa syndrome. All of them had midline lesions, and all of them were medulloblastomas, which is the pathology of the tumor type. The non-posterior fossa patients tended to be a little bit older. And there was no posterior fossa syndrome in ependymoma patients, which tended to have unilateral rather than bilateral damage and not as much midline damage. And so why is this midline a region of interest for linking something like posterior fossa syndrome to autism? Not only because of what we see in the meta-analysis in terms of lobule 9 in this midline region, what we see in terms of the VBM studies, but also because you can see it in incidental findings on MRIs. This is a typically developing control cerebellum. You can see that this is right through the midline, so this is the part that we're talking about when we refer to the vermis, and there's, in this bottom posterior part of the vermis, in the ASD brain here, you can see that that area has not developed in the same way as in the typically developing control. And this is interesting in the context also of autism because 22q13 deletion syndrome, which is an autism-associated gene, it's a syndrome involving severe developmental delay and severe expressive language impairment, also show a similar lack of this midline vermis, hypoplasia in the vermis. And so here again is a typically developing control. You're expecting to see some lovely cerebellum there, and it's not present in these children with a deletion syndrome and in some children with autism. And if we look at the patients with posterior fossa syndrome, there is damage to this posterior vermal region in all of the patients. And so again, this is something we're still working on, but it's a potential model for starting to understand the role of this region in autism, because in autism you're talking about a brain that's developing in a dynamic way. There are multiple regions of the brain that seem to be developing differently, and in order to really clarify what this particular region is contributing to that, it's helpful to look at these patients. So this is ongoing work. So for future directions, I hopefully have convinced you that topography is important. Where your findings are in the cerebellum tell you a lot about which circuits of the brain are involved between the cerebellum and the cerebral cortex. The type of thing that the cerebellum does in terms of helping the brain to learn, to become automatic, to become effective, to modulate, to adapt, to optimize both movement and potentially other aspects of cognition and behavior could be incredibly important if you think of sort of the day-to-day symptoms that you see in autism spectrum disorders. And it's important to actually include the cerebellum as part of these distributed circuits, particularly this area of right cross one, which seems to be related to social, potentially language deficits, and also this midline area of the vermis. The final direction that is still ongoing is, of course, what does the cerebellum do? We know it's involved in the modulation of behavior. We think it's involved in both motor and non-motor behavior. And in terms of a developmental aspect, the cerebellum could be potentially very important in skill acquisition. And so these are things that should be considered in the context of the circuits that we see affected in developmental disorders, including ASD. I just want to quickly acknowledge the folks in my lab. This work has been done in part by Devin Shook and Anila DeMello, who are my graduate students, a faculty research award from American University, Stuart Mostofsky, who shared the lovely brains with us in terms of the VBM analyses, and also Jeremy Schmalman, who I work with on the pediatric patient population, and folks at Mass General. So any questions? Okay, I can see you.
All right.
Oh, there we go.
Poor modulation. So, thank you for calling our brains lovely or beautiful. This is Stuart Mostofsky from Kenny Krieger Institute, Johns Hopkins. So, it's less of a question, but we talked about this a bit yesterday, but I want to put out one sort of potential notion to explain the decrease in Cruise 1 and the increase in 8A, which is that when we do motor adaptation experiments, which are highly dependent in autism, on highly dependent on the cerebellum in circuit, of course, with motor and parietal regions, We are finding that the children with autism show a bias towards reliance on proprioceptive feedback and decreased reliance on visual feedback. And so we are wondering, now seeing these findings, as well as some high degree anatomic resolution lobular findings that we've been running in our own lab, that whether or not the decreases in CRUSE-1 might reflect a lack of integration of visual to motor in adaptation, and whether the increase in 8A might be representative of the increase in the proprioceptive, and how this might then impact learning, and how the decreased integration of visual may then therefore impact the ability to rely on imitation and other visual feedback for social skill learning. So I just want to sort of put that out there as a potential explanation that I think it'll be exciting to explore.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree. It's potentially, when we talk about the cerebellum and cognition versus motor control, we're making a somewhat arbitrary distinction between what is cognition and what is movement. So, for example, I always think of the Tower of London task, where it's considered an executive function task, certainly a cognitive task, but what you're often doing when you're actually doing the task is motor planning. So you're thinking, what would happen if I move this? What would happen if I move this next step? So some might place that in a motor planning domain. Some might place that in a cognitive domain. And so certainly the capacity for social interaction is going to be impacted by a lot of potentially motor functions, including the use of visual information. Certainly the cerebellum is very much involved in the visual control of movement. So that definitely makes sense.
Quick question. You set this up very nicely for me to ask this question. I wondered if you could explain how your group differentiated high-functioning autism and Asperger's. And then, as you probably know, that is not something that's able to be done reliably, at least between groups. So probably the way that this was done was important. And when you think about the distinction, you usually think about IQ, perhaps, although it's high-functioning autism, so I don't know if that was different.
Yeah, there weren't IQ differences between the groups. And
so then there's history of language delay, or what?
Do you want me to answer?
Yes, I think that he's probably better equipped to answer
so,
that.
these are from our group. So the distinction was based on sort of the notion that in Asperger's syndrome, there is an absence of delay in early language acquisition, where in the high-functioning autism there were. We realized, as DSM-5 committee realized, that these distinctions might be blurry and it might be fuzzy, so we understand that. But that's basically how we distinguish the two groups.
Okay, great. And so then were you thinking then that it was the history of early language delay that was related to the cerebellar findings, or can you talk about that?
I don't think so. The thing is that they showed the region in which they showed these differences is a motor region of the cerebellum, and we do see the association with repetitive behaviors rather than communication or social scores. And so I was hesitant to actually show that data because of this distinction, this blurry distinction between HFA and Asperger's and the fact that it's going away. But it explains some of the reasons why we weren't seeing these volume differences in regions that we expected to see, simply because one group's going in one direction, one group's going in the other direction. And it kind of cancels out when they're all averaged together. And so in terms of what this is, the relevant difference in terms of the history, language is very much a motor task as well. And certainly the regions that we see involved in articulation is not this lobule 8 where we're seeing the differences. So it is a little bit of an enigma, but I plan on tackling the problem. And hopefully with more detailed analyses of not just the ADOS and the ADI, but of other tasks that the children have done in the motor domain and also outside of the motor domain, we can figure out what's going on in that population.
I was particularly intrigued by the differences, the differences that you saw in the high-functioning autism versus the Asperger's population, and was wondering whether these represented causes or effects, and what is sort of the temporal stability of those differences?
Well, this is looking at one time shot, so I can't really talk about in terms of the developmental effects within those children. Certainly the cause and effect is an interesting question, and it's one that's been asked in other disorders as well in terms of the cerebellar implications of what we see in the cerebellum. And because of the way the cerebellum is connected in these reciprocal loops with other areas of the brain, activity in one area is going to impact the other area, and the cerebellum is modulating activity in the cortex. It is difficult to tell where the problem starts. You have a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. And so that's why I think that the clinical populations are so important as a comparison group, because we know that what's going on in those children is cerebellar, and in the stroke patients as well. And particularly using both an adult and a developmental population, you have a brain that was affected after everything's developed, and then you have, in the pediatric kids, a brain that is still continuing to develop. And so I think that we'll be able to parse that out a little bit more with the data from the clinical populations.